Hello, and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Michael Hiltzik, business columnist for the Los Angeles Times, sitting in today for Ian Masters, who's on a rare and well-earned vacation. So here we are. It's 4 days after Thanksgiving and almost 4 weeks after Election Day. And in the same sense that some of us may still be digesting Thursday's meal, those of us who weren't forced to work on Black Thursday, in the retail sector, that is, we're still digesting the results of the election and what it bodes for the future. My first guest today will be Eric Larson. He's the author of The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. We're going to discuss the dangers to Social Security and to Medicare from the debate going on in Washington right now over the fiscal cliff, and how all the discussion in Washington about cutting the deficit at a time when we still need government stimulus to promote job creation and economic recovery is really a stalking horse for an attack on what are sometimes known as entitlements, those programs that are really crucial for keeping millions of Americans out of poverty. Then we'll be talking with Michael Grunwald, who's a national correspondent for Time magazine and the author of the recent book, The New New Deal, a terrific examination of how crucial the Obama stimulus program was to the economic recovery after 2008. And since my latest book is The New Deal, A Modern History, which deals with FDR's New Deal, we'll be comparing and contrasting these two crucial programs. And then we're going to be talking with Michael Eisen, Associate Professor of Genetics, Genomics, and Development at the University of California, Berkeley, who was one of the most articulate opponents of Proposition 37. That's the California proposition that would have required labeling of almost all genetically modified foods. That's almost all, not all. So we're going to talk with Michael Eisen about how to create legislation dealing with scientific issues that's based on genuine science, not junk science. So joining us now is Eric Larson, a longtime independent journalist and activist who's written for publications including The Nation, The Village Voice, In These Times, and The Independent. His latest book is The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric.
Hi, thanks a lot, Michael, for having me.
It's good to have you. Well, those of us who've delved into the intricacies of Social Security's financial and benefit structure over the years, I think we've all learned by bitter experience that when you take on the challenge of communicating the facts to our readers or our clients or our listeners or our political leaders, that task resembles the plight of Sisyphus, who, if you know your ancient mythology, was condemned to rolling a boulder up a mountain, only to see it roll back down again every time he got to the summit, and then, of course, he'd have to go through the same thing again. So I know you've talked and written about this, as I have. We've talked about how the Social Security Trust Fund actually possesses real assets backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, or how the program is not going bankrupt but is actually running a surplus, or how raising the retirement age really isn't all that simple if you recognize that life expectancy is only an average and that millions of Americans don't have the luxury of waiting to retire until they're 70. And then just when we get to the point when we think we've gotten these facts across, some congressman announces that he thinks the trust fund owns nothing but IOUs, or a major newspaper like the Washington Post reports that Social Security contributes to the deficit, or a candidate for president calls it a Ponzi scheme, or the moderator at the vice presidential debate declares, without any evidence at all, that Social Security is going broke and taking a larger share of the budget in the meantime. And the candidates both nod in sage agreement, and we have to roll the boulder back up to the mountaintop again. So there's a lot of ignorance out there about Social Security and especially about its origins. And it seems to me that the fiscal cliff negotiators, such as they are, have come to these talks with the mindset that something has to be done about Social Security. And where do you think that they're going wrong?
Well, they're going wrong right from that initial statement, Michael, because Social Security, to the extent that they could even implement the kinds of things they're talking about, raising the retirement age, changing the benefit formula so that it's stingier, means testing Social Security so that there's fewer benefits going to more affluent people. Those are the big three cuts that have been discussed over and over and over again in the Washington echo chamber. The problem is, even for their purposes, those cuts wouldn't really kick in for at least a decade. They wouldn't have any real impact for at least a decade. And so when they talk about Social Security as a source of deficit cutting, it really is not, because it simply wouldn't reduce the kinds of deficits they're trying to reduce over the next 10 years. So it's really kind of a stalking horse. That's really the correct phrase. The deficit is being used as an excuse to cut long-term a very vital program that in fact, younger workers are going to be depending on even more so than older workers or current retirees. It's a kind of a bait and switch. They say that their concern is the deficit. Really what they're trying to do is a radical remaking of the retirement system we have in this country for purposes, I think, mainly of making sure that taxes don't go up on the affluent in coming decades.
Right. Well, and let's talk about some of these nostrums that are often proposed to supposedly save or fix Social Security. And the way I've always greeted that idea is that these people talk about fixing Social Security the way you might talk about fixing a cat. For example, let's talk about raising the retirement age. As I pointed out, it's not nearly as simple as it sounds. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, what the downside is or what the complexity is of that?
Yeah, the problem is this, is that while it's true that average life expectancy has gone up in recent decades, and it's been going up for a long time in this country, first of all, it's not going up as fast as it used to. We're not going to have people living to 120 years old in 10 or 20 years from now. The second thing to point out is that the numbers that they have, which tell us that the average life expectancy is going up, are averages. They're not mean. They're not mean numbers. And the significance of that is that there is a substantial portion of the population that is not seeing their life expectancy going up. And guess who those people are? Those tend to be lower income people who work at dirtier and less healthy jobs. They're not investment bankers. They're not corporate lawyers.
They're not congressmen or congressional staffers either.
Certainly not. And these are people who are taking early retirement today because they don't expect to live that long. And if you suddenly tell them that retirement age for collecting Social Security is being raised, you're telling them that they're taking a benefits cut because they're not going to be able to collect Social Security for as long as they would have otherwise.
Right, and I think we should point out something that most people probably do not realize about Social Security is that the vast majority of recipients actually start taking Social Security before they're 65, certainly before they're 66 or 67, which is the normal retirement age for people entering or soon to enter their retirements. Most of them start taking it somewhere between the age of 62, which is the earliest age you can retire, and 65. And of course, if you raise the normal retirement age, as you said, you're giving those people a real benefit cut.
Absolutely. And it's really interesting to note, actually, that there was a trend going back 20, 30 years of people fewer people taking early retirement. But in the last few years, with the way people have been hit by the recession, that's reversed itself. An awful lot of people who are taking early retirement now, there are more of them, and they're doing it because they're under duress, because they have lost jobs, they have no prospect of getting another job going to really pay their way. And so they're taking early retirement as a last-ditch effort, and it would be very cruel to pull the rug out from under these people.
That's right. One other nostrum that we often hear is reducing the index to inflation, that is reducing the annual cost of living increase that recipients get. They get it most years, and it's based at this point on the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. There's been often proposals out there to change the index from the CPI to something called the chain CPI. I've written and argued that neither the CPI nor the chain CPI really reflects the cost inflation that the elderly or retirees face. What's the potential cost to the beneficiary of making these sorts of changes?
Well, the potential cost is millions of people being pushed over the poverty line, because this idea of switching to the chain CPI, it's being sold in Washington as a technical change that would make the index more accurate and that would cut costs for the taxpayer that they shouldn't have to cover. The fact is that, first of all, the chain CPI, even more so than the index that they currently use, does not reflect the rise in healthcare costs for retirees. And that's absolutely crucial, because retirees' healthcare costs are higher than the average for the population. The other thing that's it's very important to keep in mind: Social Security is not an over-generous system. It's one of the least generous systems of national retirement in the industrialized world. Many, many people who are on Social Security rely on it for half their income. I think something like a third rely on it for virtually their entire
income. Right, for at least 90%. I'm speaking with Eric Larson, a long-term independent journalist, activist, and author of the recent book, The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. And I should add here, by the way, that we've been talking about the chain CPI, and just a brief explanation. This is based on the notion that if some goods that you buy go up in price, you'll compensate for that by buying a similar product that's a little cheaper. Of course, there's a lot of debate. It's by no means established that people act the way the chain CPI seems to anticipate they do. But one way or another, it does represent a cut in the cost of living increase. That is, if Social Security benefits were based on the chain CPI rather than the standard CPI, and certainly rather than on the CPIE, which is a special market basket that's designed to reflect the costs faced by seniors, including by overrepresenting healthcare inflation. Now, Eric, the subtitle of your book is, as we've said, is The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. It seems to me that the attack on Social Security really dates back almost to its inception, certainly before Reagan. We can remember that in 1936, the GOP challenger to Franklin Roosevelt and Roosevelt's first reelection campaign was Alf Landon, and his platform was almost exclusively based on an attack on Social Security. But the attack, there's been an attack by conservatives really since 1935, and I'd be interested to hear your views on what is the source of this longstanding hostility toward Social Security that we've seen over the decades, really over 8 decades since its inception.
Well, there's a couple of things. Ideologically, the Republican Party and actually significant sections of the sort of more center-right portion of the Democratic Party have never really been comfortable with the idea of Social Security, have never really regarded it as legitimate, because it's a form of mutual aid. It's called generically a social insurance program, and what that means is that people contribute to a common fund that's used to pay benefits for that same group of people when they're in need. And that's always been seen as a kind of a violation of the capitalist system. A socialistic import from Europe is what it was called in the years before the Social Security Act was passed, when reformers were trying to institute something like it. That was what it was always denounced as. The other reason, I think, is a little more pragmatic, which is that we do have an aging population, and there's going to have to be more resources allocated to the elderly in the decades ahead. And I think that the 1%, which is a useful way to think about the sort of the super affluent, at the beginning of the end of the day, they're all about making sure that their taxes do not go up, that they can preserve this very advantageous tax system that they've been putting in place really since the Carter administration, not even since Reagan, since the Carter administration. And their concern is that if Social Security is not cut and restructured, and those costs cannot be shifted from the government onto individual working households, then ultimately the taxes on the affluent will have to go up, at least somewhat. And the whole goal here is to make sure that doesn't happen, to make sure that the responsibility for paying for the elderly and covering their costs is shifted away from the collectivity, from taxpayers, from government, onto individual households. The problem with this, of course, is that increasingly individual households can't afford it. They don't have a lot of other resources.
Right. In fact, this was the burden that Social Security was actually enacted to relieve households of. The idea was that each generation was being held back by the burden of paying for the older generation. So we were going to share that. I think we should point out here, by the way, that one of the phenomena that's happened and that the 1% is really fighting against is that their tax cut, that's to say the Bush tax cut, was largely financed by the payroll tax, that is the tax that mostly the middle class and the working class pay in to finance their own Social Security benefits. Because Social Security has been in a surplus, that surplus is lent to the federal government, and since 2001, the surplus has been used to pay for wars and whatever else the government does without burdening the income tax, which is paid mostly by the upper middle class and the wealthy. Now one thing I wanted to really wanted to touch on before we close is the idea that there seems to be a lot of doubt in the progressive community and, in fact, among Social Security advocates that President Obama is really going to stand up for Social Security, not only in the fiscal cliff negotiations but in general. I find a lot of skepticism, a lot of parsing of his words when he talks about the need to tweak Social Security, whether that's a harbinger of something much more serious than merely a tweak. There seems to be a sense that he accepts this idea that that Social Security is an entitlement that needs to be pared back. Do you hear the same thing, and what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, there's very solid reasons for being concerned about this. Every president since Jimmy Carter, Democrat as well as Republican, that includes Barack Obama, has tried at one point or another in their presidency to cut Social Security. Obama attempted to make a deal in 2011 with John Boehner that would have instituted this stingier chain CPI index as a way to cut Social Security. And there's every reason to believe that may be what Obama envisions as being part of the package that he and the Republicans will eventually, in the next couple of months or very shortly, conclude as sort of their compromise over the fiscal cliff. Now, the good news is that progressive groups and organized labor have been determined not to get caught blindsided by this. There was a lot more sort of indulgence of Obama when he was first elected, and really the watchword among progressive groups and labor dating to the early days of this election was, let's get him reelected and then let's be on our guard. So I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of pressure from progressive groups to keep that from happening, but it's going to be difficult because centrist Democrats, who really are the swing constituency in all this in Washington, are going to be pushing very hard for some kind of a grand bargain that would include cuts in entitlements. This is something we can't afford to see. Working people can't afford to see. And this is why I wrote the book, The People's Pension, on a certain level, is that I think that this fight is going to show us really what kind of country this United States is going to be in the future. Right. Are we going to be a country that values human beings as such, or are we going to be a country that values them only as numbers in some kind of actuarial value equation? This is absolutely crucial, and a showdown on it really is in the works here because of the fiscal cliff.
Okay. All right. Again, I've been speaking with Eric Larson, a long-term independent journalist, activist, and author of the recent book, The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. And thanks for having joined us today, Eric.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
And when we are going to take a brief station break now, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Michael Grunwald, national correspondent for Time magazine, and we'll be talking about his latest book, The New New Deal, a great examination of how crucial the Obama stimulus program has been to the economic recovery since 2008.
Send me a postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view. Indicate precisely what you mean to say. You're sincerely wasting away. Give me your answer. Still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other? Like you would to a sister or a brother. It could be said, cosmopolitan style.
Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Michael Hiltzik, sitting in for Ian Masters. And joining us now is Michael Grunwald, Time Magazine's senior national correspondent. Michael previously spent nearly a decade at the Washington Post, where he served as congressional correspondent, New York bureau chief, and national investigative reporter. He is the recipient of the George Polk Award for National Reporting, the Worth Bingham Prize for Investigative Reporting, among other honors. And his latest book is The New New Deal, which I really recommend for how it deconstructed the Obama stimulus program and showed how successful it really was in helping the economic recovery. Michael, welcome to Background Briefing.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Michael. I really admire your work on the old New Deal.
Well, thank you. We can use our books as sort of bookends to this discussion. I want to start by talking about one of the themes of your book and also a theme of a lot of the talks and presentations you've given on the subject of the Obama stimulus since your book's publication, and that's how groupthink in Washington produced this notion that the stimulus had failed. And how damaging was that notion, and how far did it spread? Clearly, it was all the rage within the Beltway. Did you find it also out in the countryside?
Well, sure. You know, as you mentioned, I lived for a long time in Washington, but now I'm in the public policy paradise of South Beach. And I have to say, I think if I still lived in D.C., I doubt I ever could have written this book. The idea that the stimulus was anything other than this $800 billion joke was just preposterous. It showed that, even taking it seriously, showed that you sort of didn't get it. When I told a lot of my friends in D.C. that I was working on this, they really thought I had lost my mind. And even my editors, when I pitched them stories on the stimulus, I felt like that kid in the newsroom on HBO who's always pitching the story about how Bigfoot is real. I mean, it really is I think the reason that the media messed up this story as badly as they messed up, really any story since the run-up to the war on Iraq, is because of this notion that, the narrative in Washington just gets calcified so quickly. And I think this was a sort of odd combination of kind of Republicans doing a really good job of making this sound like, it was all about honeybee insurance and levitating trains to Disneyland and all kinds of other nonsense that wasn't in the stimulus, and Democrats not really being that interested in defending it, and Obama having some problems with his message, and the kind of understandable difficulty of a jobs bill passed at a time when jobs were hemorrhaging. But it all created this sort of perfect storm where national reporters who aren't very interested in public policy were able to just sort of scoff and roll their eyes and say, oh, yeah, the stimulus, it failed. And it had a real impact on the country. I mean, it's not a coincidence that even though, more than 90% of economists agree that this thing has created jobs and produced growth,
the percentage of Americans a year after this thing passed who believed that the stimulus was had created any jobs at all was lower than the percentage of Americans who believed Elvis was alive.
Right.
So that groupthink has a real impact.
And that still is sort of out there, out and abroad. And you mentioned this issue of Obama not really being able to communicate his message. And it's a good question as to how much we should blame Obama and the Democrats for that. I mean, one difference between Franklin Roosevelt and Barack Obama that I've talked about, drawing a line from my book, is that FDR never let the sun set without making sure that voters understood how much his New Deal had achieved and what was at stake in every election. And it seems to me that today's Democrats, on the other hand, maybe until perhaps the closing weeks of the last election, seemed to have this habit of running away from their successes. I mean, healthcare reform was not to be mentioned during the 2010 election, which of course the Democrats got trounced. And there never seemed to be a full-throated defense of the stimulus. And there didn't seem to be one really throughout much of this last presidential campaign. So how much should we blame Obama? How much should we blame this Democratic Party tendency to run away from its successes? And how much should we blame the press for not being willing to listen to the story?
Well, Michael, I wouldn't disagree with anything you said. I mean, I think, you know, believe me, and it's certainly as somebody who had written a book where the subtitle is The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era, it's been frustrating for me today, like, how come this Obama guy won't talk about all that change? That said, I always try to point out that this black guy whose middle name is Hussein and got himself elected president of the United States twice probably isn't a political idiot. And it was a different situation from FDR. And one thing that Larry Summers noticed in December 2008, and he said to some of his fellow economists on the Obama team, is he said that, you know, FDR was lucky. He had 2 years of depression before he took office. Everybody knew that it was Hoover's depression. And I do think that Obama, you know, the financial earthquake had hit, but the economic tsunami hadn't really reached the shore. So he took office at this time when we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. GDP was crashing at a 9% annual rate. But people weren't really feeling that badly yet. They had the sense that something bad was happening. But most of the pain actually happened after Obama took office. And so there is a sense that it's not clear that any kind of stimulus could have actually prevented the stimulus from looking bad. Ultimately, it was a jobs bill passed at a time when jobs were hemorrhaging. And although I detail and kind of, you know, nauseating minutia some of the messaging mistakes that I think Obama has made, I'm not sure that a really fantastic message would have made double-digit unemployment a lot more palatable to the American people.
Well, you may be right about that. In fact, I remember one of the very few interviews that I had with Larry Summers, in which he talked about how the public response to economic change is not sudden and not really blunt, but it's more like a rheostat, that bad times sort of infiltrate the public consciousness slowly and build, and then recovery does the same thing on the other end. And I think we were, in this last election, really on the cusp of recovery just beginning to penetrate the public consciousness in time for them to cast their votes. Now, that being said, when you and I, back in August, did a book salon on firedoglake.com, it was a great conversation. One of the questioners in the audience, so to speak, wrote in to say that his grandfather had got actual work during the Great Depression from the New Deal, and he didn't see Obama creating any actual work. And that sort of reminded me of an old line that I think one of my history professors had told me in college, which was, you should never underestimate the importance of a symbol. FDR seemed to have some big, iconic public works projects to point to as symbols of the New Deal. Triborough Bridge in New York was one, probably the biggest one, and he even claimed credit for Hoover Dam, even though that was not a New Deal project, and in fact, he had taken Hoover's name off it. Now, Obama didn't seem to be able to do the same thing, or at least not to the same extent, and do you think it would have helped to at least get the point across if he had some monumental physical manifestation to point to?
Well, sure. Well, one of the things I try to point out is that while, you know, they didn't have, you know, a Skyline Drive or, you know, a Triborough Bridge or a Grand Coulee Dam, they did have the largest dam removal project in the history of the United States to restore salmon runs on the Elwha River. And it did have, you know, a half dozen of the world's largest solar farms and America's largest wind farm and a dozen of America's first cellulosic biofuel refineries and 30 new advanced battery factories that really created a sort of supply chain for electric vehicles out of thin air in the United States. Now, again, these were different kind of icons, and they're not the kind of icons maybe that people encounter in their lives every day, and they're not the kind of icon like Fort Knox that becomes a sort of part of America's, you know, sort of cultural who we are. But look, you know, the new deal hired millions of people to work directly at these alphabet agencies like the WPA and the CCC, and certainly Obama's new deal did not do that. It didn't really create big government because FDR had already created it. But that said, it did employ directly at its peak about 750,000 people, and it added 2.5 million to 3 million jobs. Just about all the economists agree over what we would have had otherwise. And really the problem was that we had an 8 million job hole, and that it wasn't really, as Vice President Biden liked to say, it wasn't supposed to carry the whole sleigh. I think if unemployment had been lower, people would have felt better about some of the icons that we had. And then the other thing I should point out is that two of the major icons that Obama was counting on ended up being killed by Republicans. One was high-speed rail, specifically the train in Florida, which was supposed to be the first bullet train, was supposed to be coming online right about now, and Governor Rick Scott of Florida killed it when he was elected in 2010. And the other was a nationwide school building initiative that was supposed to pour $10 billion into really reinvigorating the physical stock and greening America's schools. And Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, the Republican senator, said she wouldn't vote for the stimulus if that wasn't taken out. And, you know, bills that don't get 60 votes in the Senate don't make change, so it came out. And maybe that would have been the sort of iconic thing people could have pointed to.
Right, and I think you haven't mentioned, I'm not entirely sure this was part of the Obama stimulus, but it was certainly emblematic of this Republican mindset. Chris Christie, who we're supposed to honor these days as a paragon of bipartisanship and clear thinking, killed a tunnel project from New Jersey into Manhattan because he said his state couldn't afford it, even though it was going to be funded largely by the federal government. And of course,
that absolutely was stimulus funded. And in fact, some of the money, you know, people talk about how there was going to be so much waste in the stimulus. In fact, that's some of the only money that you can say was actually wasted. Was some of the money that was spent planning that tunnel that Chris Christie just killed. It turned out people said that 5 to 7% of the stimulus would be lost to fraud. The actual numbers has turned out to be 0.001%. But yes, no, that's a perfect example of something of a iconic project that was killed. That said, there were three iconic New York City projects that went ahead. The Moynihan Station and the, you know, the sort of the new Penn Station got a lot of stimulus money, and that's starting to happen. A connection from the Long Island Railroad to Grand Central, where I grew up in Long Island, so that's a big deal to my family.
That's right. So did I, and I remembered the difficulty of getting from Penn Station to
the Second Avenue Subway, which on the east side is the something that people have been dreaming about for decades. And those are all going to be huge, iconic projects. The New York Times Magazine did a whole photo essay on the work on the Second Avenue Subway. It's just that people don't think of them as stimulus projects. They weren't branded in the same way that the old New Deal was.
And of course, what's important about all of those is that it's infrastructure and the savings to the economy and the growth that they're going to inspire in the economy really have to be tallied as part of the impact of the stimulus. Now, one of the common threads linking the old New Deal that I've written about and the new Deal that you've written about is that in terms of fiscal stimulus, as we understand it, it may be that neither was big enough to actually achieve all of the recovery that was necessary. Now, in the 30s, The reason is that FDR and his New Dealers and his brain trust didn't really understand the concept of fiscal stimulus. John Maynard Keynes wasn't well known in the U.S. yet. He hadn't really his codification of deficit spending in hard times hadn't penetrated these shores. So their fiscal stimulus programs were really aimed at relief and work assistance. And there's a great line from Corey Brown, an economist of the 50s, saying that the fiscal stimulus didn't fail in the 1930s. It simply wasn't tried. And I think you pointed out that there was a lot of discussion in the White House about how big the fiscal stimulus should be when the Obama administration came into office. But it clearly was, and there's been a lot of criticism about this, it was pared back from what really would have been necessary. Is that a fair assessment of what happened?
I think it's true that certainly more stimulus would have been better. That, you know, more aid to states would have prevented more layoffs of teachers and firefighters and police officers and other public employees. More tax cuts would have put more money into taxpayers' pockets. You know, more aid to victims of the Great Recession would have done the same. And more public works obviously would have put more unemployed construction workers on the job. That's true. One thing I think I really documented in the book is that there was no political appetite for one dime more than Obama got. You had three Republican senators and at least half a dozen Democrats drawing a line in the sand at $800 billion. And it turned out that later, after the original stimulus, Obama did go back and get another about $700 billion worth that did help. You know, it's one of the main reasons that the U.S. economy, while not great, has been growing, while you've seen Europe, which really embraced austerity, has had a double-dip recession, has been because Obama was able to keep pushing for some more stimulus in 2009 and 2010.
He didn't
run out around the country and say, I want a second stimulus, because the S word had become toxic by then. But there's no doubt that, you know, if Paul Krugman were czar, he doesn't need a supermajority to pass his column, but if he got to decide how big the stimulus was, it would have been bigger, and that would have been better. But the Obama people really were at the, as they say, we thought we were in the deep end of the pool, and they really were. A bunch of liberal economists wrote a letter in November 2008 saying that Obama needed to go big, he needed to be bold, he needed at least a $350 billion stimulus. And of course he got twice that, and now most of those same economists are whining that he's such a wimp, he's such a sellout, why didn't he go bigger?
Right. Well, of course, that points to the old adage that politics is really the art of the possible. And one thing that I think both of us have probably noticed is that both FDR and Barack Obama came into office with a lot of support from progressives, and progressives are always the first people, the first politically involved class to decide that that their favorite candidates aren't measuring up. And FDR came under a lot of criticism from the left for not for giving away too much to Wall Street, even though he had passed two great securities regulatory bills. And of course, we've heard over and over again that Barack Obama somehow isn't as progressive as we'd like. Well,
I've taken a lot of abuse because I do call them the disillusionment addicts of the left in the book. And I just do feel, you know, the people who say, why was there no public option in healthcare reform? Why was there no, why didn't he break up the banks and financial reform? One thing, President Obama, he did run as a pragmatist, even after all that fancy rhetoric. And he did understand that bills that don't pass Congress don't make change. And he needed 60 votes.
Right.
And he didn't have 60 votes for a public option, and he didn't have 60 votes for breaking up the banks, and he didn't have 60 votes for a stimulus that, you know, would have buttered everybody's bread and solved every national problem. Certainly my book sort of makes the case that, you know, launching a clean energy revolution and digitizing medicine and, the most ambitious education reform since LBJ and the largest infrastructure investment since Eisenhower and the largest middle class tax cut since Reagan and the largest research investments ever, But that was pretty good for his first month in office.
That's what he got, and that's right. It's an impressive record. Well, thank you again for joining us today, Michael Grunwald.
It's been a pleasure. Really, thanks so much.
And once again, I've been speaking with Michael Grunwald, Time Magazine's senior national correspondent and the author of The New Deal, great analysis of the Obama stimulus. We're going to take a station break now, and after we come back, we'll be talking with Michael Eisen, a professor of biology at the University of California at Berkeley and an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Michael Hiltzik, sitting in for Ian Masters. My guest right now is Michael Eisen, a professor of biology at the University of California at Berkeley and an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. His research encompasses evolution, development, genetics, genomics, chemical ecology, and behavior, and he's a strong proponent of open science and a co-founder of the Public Library of Science, which is a great publisher of scientific work. And we're here to talk about Proposition 37, which, as you may know, was the California ballot proposition on the last ballot that was designed as an antidote to genetically modified foods. Proposition 37 was defeated at the polls after a multi-million dollar campaign against it, financed by mostly food processors and the agricultural industry. It was billed as a consumer-friendly measure that gave people power over the food industry by forcing manufacturers to label their goods at the store if they were produced through genetic modification. Some supporters also had the idea, and one of them was Dr. Eisen's Berkeley colleague, Michael Pollan, that passage of Proposition 37 would launch a nationwide pure food movement. Michael, thanks for joining me and welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Great. Well, you are the proprietor of a fascinating blog entitled It Is Not Junk, and that's at michaeleisen.org, michaeleisen.org. And I hope I'm not embarrassing you by saying that you've done more for scientists and laypersons over the years than many other people by establishing the Public Library of Science, which, as I said, is a publisher of scientific journals designed to make research more available, not less, and where I believe you're still on the board, if
correct.
I'm correct. Now, you wrote fairly extensively about Proposition 37 during the campaign, and one of your great posts on it was entitled Proposition 37 and the Right to Know Nothing. Your argument was that this was a measure that was not going to achieve what its supporters claimed it achieved. And why don't we start by you're giving us a bit on where you thought it went wrong.
So, I mean, I think the central problem with Prop 37 was that it presented itself and was trying to sell itself to the voters as a simply a measure to provide information to consumers. The signs that went up all over California, especially in Berkeley, were about people having the right to know. The ads were about consumers having the right to know, and yet the proposition itself and most of the rhetoric behind it showed no interest in actually informing consumers about the technology. It really was about giving consumers a quick and easy way to avoid a technology that they were, you know, that they were afraid of for various reasons, most of which I think are invalid, and that the pitch was basically you have a right to know, and then you know didn't take any steps to try to inform consumers about the technology, as if the right to know was simply a right to avoid. And to me, the reason I was so put off by this initiative was that, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding about the technology of genetic modification. I think there's a lot of fear in the amongst the consumers, largely born out of a lack of understanding and a lack of knowledge about you know what's involved in the technology and how it works and why that a lot of people who understand it don't think that it's particularly dangerous. And the initiative, instead of trying to address the lack of understanding in the public about the underlying science, chose simply to make science and this particular scientific technology a kind of boogeyman for everything that people don't like about the food industry and so forth. And to me, I felt this was a sort of unconscionable attack on science. It was an attack on the importance of having a rational discussion about technology and its benefits and risks, and that this, rather than promoting a better public understanding of science and technology, was doing exactly the opposite. It was encouraging people to be afraid of the technology. It was you know, people, the proponents of Prop 37 were often reaching for completely discredited ideas and fears and research about the risks of the technology, and showed no interest in trying to educate the public about what it's actually doing.
Right, and it seems to me that one of the indicators of this is that it treated genetic modification as though it were really one technology, when in fact it's sort of a blanket description of a whole wide range of techniques used in developing seed stocks and hybridization and all sorts of things, some of which may have implications for the environment, some have not, and some of which are clearly aimed at reducing the risk of ingesting certain foods rather than having the effect of enhancing them.
Right. I mean, it's a complicated field. I mean, the technology has advanced dramatically in 20 years. There's a lot of different things that people are already doing, or, you know, ways in which the technology is already used in agriculture, and there's many, many more to come as genetic technology gets more advanced and more powerful. And you're exactly right. You know, the idea that the proper way to treat this technology is simply to slap a label on food, treat it all the same, and not take any steps to differentiate between not only the different types of underlying methods used to generate these technologies, the type of transformations that they wrought, and the ways in which they're used. This all was assumed to be irrelevant to consumers, and that the only thing they'd be interested in it was that this technology was used in creating a plant. Which, even if you give credence to some of the fears people have about the risks of particular pieces of genetic technology, which I don't, but even if you do, consumers should want to know what the particular modification is, how it was used, what kinds of things it encouraged the farmers to
do. Right. They should know more and should try to know more. Again, I'm speaking with Michael Eisen, professor of biology at the University of California at Berkeley, an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. And we're talking about Proposition 37. Michael, a moment ago you made a reference to some of the studies or some of the assertions about GMOs that were seized upon by the pro-Proposition 37 lobby and communicated to the public. You and I have talked in the past, and I wrote a column about a study that had been produced by a French researcher named Gilles Seralini that made quite a splash during the campaign. Listeners may recall some of the news reports about the study. It included, it purported to say that, to show that that rats that had been fed genetically modified corn had developed really grotesque tumors, and there were photographs that accompanied the article and that were widely published of some of these rats and really gross tumors, clearly designed to disgust the reading public and to enhance the sentiment against GMOs and thus in favor of Proposition 37. Now, when I saw the study and was preparing to write about it, I spent a lot of time talking to experts, reading other scientific studies, trying to take the measure of the discrediting of this study that had been fairly widespread in the scientific community. But I do this I do this sort of investigation as part of my job. Most laypersons don't have the ability to do that. And that raises a question that maybe you can address, which is how should the average person, when confronted with what purports to be authoritative scientific evidence but is really discreditable, how should newspaper readers or TV viewers or just interested parties assess this sort of complicated data?
Right. I mean, I think there's a big issue, perhaps a bigger issue to discuss there, which is that the public doesn't really have they're not engaged in the process of science in an active way. I mean, this is one of the things that led us to start the Public Library of Science, actually, which is far bigger than just the genetic modification issue, but that there is a serious problem with the way that scientists try to communicate to the public. The study authors did not really attempt to engage the public in the research process that they were undertaking, why it was that they designed the study this way, how it was that the study could inform the public about the safety or lack thereof of genetic technology. Instead, they engaged in a press campaign trying to scare the public about the risk. And I think the problem is the public isn't really in a good position to read a study like that and understand why it's where its flaws come from. And I think this is to me is one of the things that is going wrong more broadly in our public interactions around science that is exemplified by Prop 37, which is that people don't view scientists as honest brokers in any of these issues. That most of the people in the pro Prop 37 side assume that anybody involved in science who was commenting on the validity or wisdom of these studies was intrinsically tainted by their association with scientific research. And I wish I had a good and simple answer for how to address this. But I think one of the ways to do it is to make sure that legislative efforts that are formulated around bad science, fears of science, and a lack of understanding of the technology are not allowed to go forward. One of the things I think is good about the defeat of Prop 37 is that it forces people who are interested in promoting labeling on genetic technology to try to come at it from a more scientifically valid way that won't anger and upset the scientific community. And I think that that the Seralini study is an example of something that's gotten really bad in our public discourse around science. People want to read scientific studies like Republicans in the later days of this campaign wanted to read polls. They'd search around trying to find a poll that would come down on their side of the issue, and then they would trumpet its results. People in Prop 37 were doing the same thing with science. They, rather than trying to look at the accumulated body of information around genetic technology, look at 20 or 30 years worth of studies into its safety, think about the basic molecular biology that leads a lot of scientists like me to conclude that this is not a particularly risky technology. They don't care about that. They want to find one gotcha study and say, aha, this is a disaster. Look what it did to these poor little rats.
This sort of technique really does lend itself to misrepresentation. And it seems to me that you're in a way making an argument against legislating on these sorts of issues where it's so complicated, legislating through the initiative process where inevitably the debate unfolds in 30-second television commercials rather than in hearings and the presentation of real evidence. Now, we're going to have to wrap up in just a few minutes, so I want to take the last two or three minutes to ask you. You made the point, I think, during the campaign that if the promoters of Proposition 37 really were devoted to the idea of providing consumers with the most useful information, they would have written Prop 37 in a different way. Give me some ideas, if you can, as to what you think an effective bill might have had. And once again, we only have a couple of minutes left.
So I think that I believe that the public would benefit from a better understanding about how food is produced, what kind of what kind of seeds and stock and so forth went into their production. And so what I think should happen, and what I think that would have been successful had it been proposed, is an effort to have more comprehensive food labeling in which consumers are provided with information, whether it's just on a label or on a QR code on food products or whatever, with as much information as is practical about the origins of the varieties that were used in the product, the farming practices that were used in producing them, and so forth. That would include, but not be restricted to, genetic modification. I think this would achieve the kind of consumer-powered interaction with the agriculture industry that people like Michael Pollan were promoting. And what's more, I think it would lead to a better and more general understanding of in amongst consumers of the ways in which these technologies are being used today and why they're being used. That is a labeling initiative that was actually trying to provide consumers with information about the agricultural practices behind the products that they are buying and consuming would have been much, much, much more popular and much more successful and might have withstood the millions of dollars of advertising that came from the No on 37 side. And I really hope that the people who are backing this initiative will take that as their next step forward to make real food labeling rather than sort of anti-science scare tactics.
All right. Well, thanks very much. Thank you for joining us today. I've been speaking with Michael Eisen, professor of biology at the University of California, Berkeley, an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and one of the founders of the Public Library of Science, which is basically a new model for communicating scientific information to other scientists and to the public. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Michael Hiltzik, business columnist for the Los Angeles Times, sitting in for Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. We'll be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. with more interesting guest hosts throughout the week while Ian takes his well-deserved vacation. Bye for now.